Good afternoon, everyone. The subject of my talk this afternoon is selflessness. And I'd like to start off with a brief teaching from Wei Wu Wei. This really summarizes, I think, the whole of the talk. He said, "Why are you unhappy? Because 99.9% of everything you think and of everything you do is for yourself, and there isn't one." That's it. I can leave. I can remember when I first started attending longer retreats at IMS and Spirit Rock, and this was now some time ago. Sometimes there would be a discussion that would be shared with the group from the teachers about a reluctance to talk about selflessness because there was some concern that people would be upset when they heard this teaching. I reflect on this now with some confusion, and I don't know if that's still the case, because this is, in essence, the core of the Buddha's teaching and the core of freedom to understand this. So I hope you don't get upset, and hopefully, rather than being upset, actually, it is beneficial for you. The insight into selflessness is really the door to freedom. I remember Jack Kornfield saying once that he met a monk in Sri Lanka when he was visiting and practicing there. And this monk was constantly smiling and seemed so at peace. So Jack asked him, "Why are you always so happy?" And he said, "No self, no problem." This kind of summarizes it. The concept of having or being an independent self really is the result of a superficial perception of our experience. And without a deeper investigation, this self-concept is clung to and blocks our ability to really see the truth of our experience and our inherent freedom. Nothing has a self or a substantial unchanging core as part of its nature. So one of the most important perceptions we need to investigate is this perception of what we usually refer to as myself. If you went outside tonight, and if it's clear, and you looked up in the northern sky, you would see a constellation or a pattern of stars. And when we look at that pattern of seven stars, most of us would immediately say, "Oh, there's the Big Dipper." There is no Dipper there, but when the mind sees the pattern, it names the pattern Big Dipper. And I've actually, after hearing this, went out and tried to look at the pattern and not see the Big Dipper. It's really difficult. The mind immediately sees the pattern, there's the Dipper. We know there's no Dipper there, but we apply that concept to the pattern. It's the same when we look at ourselves. There's a pattern of changing elements of mind and body that we then refer to as me or myself, as if it referred to something, or someone in this case, that actually existed, endured over time, and was who we actually are. When we investigate this, what I'm referring to as myself, it's important to remember that we're not trying to eliminate the self. You can't eliminate something that doesn't exist. We're trying to see through the illusion of self, the misperception that there is something that is enduring over time that we identify with, rather than seeing it's nothing but the changing pattern of the five elements, five aggregates, I should say, or what they're often referred to as the five aggregates of clinging. Because when we cling to any of these aggregates, the sense of self, the self-construct arises. The Buddha divided this psychophysical organism in many ways to help us see its composite and changing nature. So one way was the five aggregates. Another way is called the six sense bases. Another way is the five elements. So these are just arbitrary ways of starting to investigate and subdivide what we think of as a solid whole, as subdividing and understanding the truth of who I am. So I'd like to take a few moments to explore the five aggregates with you as part of our investigation into this thing called selflessness. In the teaching on the five aggregates, The Buddha took the body and mind and broke it down into the body with its five senses. He called that form or rupa in Pali. And then he took the mind and divided it into four elements: feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. And he called that nama, which translates as name. So when the Buddha was looking at an individual, rather than seeing a self, he would see nama rupa, name and form. He wouldn't believe that there was a person there. So just to review, feeling, remember, is the quality of sense experiences being either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. In each moment of our experience, we're having a sight, a smell, a sound, a thought, and in each of those moments, we will experience those as being either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. That's feeling. And it's important because of the mind's reaction to the feelings. Because when the feeling is positive, pleasant, the mind wants to hold on to it. When the feeling is negative, unpleasant, the mind wants to push it away. When the feeling is neither pleasant nor unpleasant, neutral, that's when the mind tends to space out and go on automatic pilot. So we want to be aware of feeling and the mind's reaction to feeling, so it doesn't become automatic, that we can bring some awareness to that process. The next one is perception, what I referred to the other night, and it's the ability of the mind to discriminate, identify, classify, and in conjunction with memory, it stores the information so the next time we have a sight or a sound or a smell, we can recognize what that is. That's the role of perception. So if I hear a sound, it's just vibrations causing the eardrum to vibrate, and it's perception that recognizes, oh, that's a dog or that's a car. So that's the role of perception. Mental formations is the blanket term to cover really all the intellectual, intentional, and emotional aspects of our experience. And remember, there are 52 mental formations, but the Buddha extracted feeling and perception because of how important they are in terms of our understanding of how we operate. The fifth of the five aggregates is consciousness. It's the knowing quality of mind. You might think of it as like a motion detector, that when there's something happening, a sight, then there's seeing consciousness. It recognizes that that's occurring. Or if there's a sound, then there's hearing consciousness. So there's a consciousness associated with each one of the six senses. Now you say, six senses, I'm only aware of five. In this tradition, the mind is the sixth sense organ. So eyes see, ears hear, noses smell, minds think. So that's what I mean by the sixth sense organ. And therefore, there are also six kinds of consciousness. One kind of consciousness for each one of the six senses. So there's hearing consciousness, seeing consciousness, mind consciousness, if you will. I want to clarify the difference, because it's really important, between the conditioned consciousness, I might say consciousness with a small c, that arises as a result of seeing, hearing, or smelling, versus consciousness with a big C, the unconditioned consciousness, which what we also might refer to as awareness with a capital A, or one mind in some traditions, or even we might call that presence. Individually, none of these five aggregates that I've been talking about make up what we refer to as a person. But we put them together, however, and the result is what we refer to as a Bill or a Daryl or a Janet. Now, one of the traditional teaching examples employs a chariot, but I'd like to update that a little and make a more appropriate to our age. I'll use a car. So if I have four tires, is that a car? No, it's four tires. What if I have an engine? It's not a car, it's an engine. What about the chassis? What about the body? What about the interior? So I've got five components. None of them individually is a car. But we put these five components together, and we then say, that's a car. It's a concept we apply to this pattern of what happens when these five elements come together. It's the same with the aggregates. Individually, none of the aggregates make up a self. So the body is not a person. Now, sometimes when I'm teaching mindfulness-based stress reduction, in the beginning, people are identified with their body. They say, well, this is me. And I say, well, what would happen if I cut off your arm? Would there be any less of you? And they go, no, there'd be less of the body. So you can't be the body, then, can you? So we're not the body. We're not our thoughts. We're not our feelings, our perceptions. We're not consciousness. None of these individually make up a person. But put all these five aggregates together, and we have what we would refer to as a person. That's a concept that we are applying to this pattern of what happens when the five aggregates come together. Now, I don't know how many of you have been to Niagara Falls. My wife and I usually do one cycling trip a year there. And there's a lovely trail that runs along the edge of the gorge, and you could look down on the falls, but also you can look down on the whirlpool. There's actually a little cable car that goes across. And so we might call that the Niagara Falls Whirlpool. And so often when we're cycling by, we'll look down and we'll see the whirlpool. And from a distance, from day to day, the whirlpool looks pretty much the same. Now, we know it's not the same. It's a changing pattern of water, but we call it the Niagara Falls Whirlpool. If we got really close to it, we would realize and see clearly the constantly changing nature of the whirlpool. So we might label it the Niagara Falls Whirlpool, but we'd be using a static concept to apply to something that was changing constantly. So I might suggest it might be more accurate to say that what we see as water whirlpooling, because that really incorporates that changing the motion that's there, that it's not static. Even though the pattern looks the same, it's changing components within the pattern. That would be more accurately describing its true nature. So there is a pattern, if we use a static concept, that we might call Bill. That maintains its general form over time and when seen from a distance with a superficial perception. But if there was perception with mindfulness, we could see this mind-body pattern is actually not static, it's constantly changing. So it might be more accurate not to say that's Bill, but that's billing. Okay? We're seeing this combined aggregates as a changing, flowing process, because that's actually the truth of what's happening. What we consider ourselves to be is merely a constellation of changing material and mental elements that are in a constant state of flux, but without penetrating deeply, we only see the superficial perception and think there is a self behind, as part of, or in control of the experience. That's with a superficial perception. Much like in the example I gave on Monday when the teacher was talking to the students about the apple and the color of the apples. The teacher couldn't get beyond the superficial perception to see that really at the heart of it all, apples are all white. At least I believe they're all white. Are there any apples that are different on the inside? I think it's all white. So I'll accept that as being the truth. One of the goals of our practice, as I mentioned previously, is to see life as it truly is, to see ourselves as we truly are. I've often heard it said that spiritual practice is not about discovering who you are. That's the work of psychotherapy. Spiritual practice is about discovering who you are not, but thought yourself to be. Let me repeat that. So the goal of psychotherapy is to develop a sense of self, presumably a positive sense of self. That's the goal of psychotherapy. The goal of spiritual practice is to discover who you are not, but thought yourselves to be. When we let go of all the things that we think we are, our jobs, our roles, our bodies, our gender, what remains is space or freedom. It's identifying with the misperception that there is something enduring which we call a self that prevents us from seeing our inherent freedom, which I might refer to as enlightenment. At least that's a term that's used in some traditions. So one could say that enlightenment does not result from purification of the self or this I process, trying to make it better. Enlightenment is the transcendence of the self or the I process. Zen master Kalfried von Durkheim said, a saint is someone who has perfected their I process, and a sage is someone who has transcended it. So the goal of our practice is not to become saints, it's to become sages, to see and to be able to transcend what we normally think of as the self. Probably one of the more famous teachings in the Buddhist tradition is called the teaching, the Bahiya Sutra. And it's often useful when you read one of the teachings attributed to the Buddha to understand the background story behind the teaching. It gives it a whole other level of interest and, I think, context. So Bahiya was a monk, but not one of the Buddha's disciples. And as many people in that time were doing, he was engaged in spiritual practice, trying to reach enlightenment. And one day he said to his cousin, who was also engaged in this kind of practice, he said, I've reached enlightenment. And the cousin said, sorry, Bahiya, I don't think you've reached enlightenment. Now, Bahiya wasn't identified strongly with that, so he got off that position and said, well, who is enlightened? And his cousin said, well, the Buddha is enlightened. So wanting to reach enlightenment, Bahiya set off in search of the Buddha, and after several months of arduous journey, finally found the Buddha and his disciples. But when he came to the Buddha at that time was on his alms round. And so Bahiya said to the Buddha, please, sir, teach me what you have to, you know, what you have to teach so I can learn, because I want to be enlightened. And the Buddha said, I'd be happy to do this, but I'm on my alms rounds right now. Let me get my food. I'll have my lunch, maybe a little nap. And then if you come and see me around 2 o'clock, I'd be glad to teach you. Bahiya said, but sir, I've traveled from a great distance. Please share with me your teachings. And the Buddha again said, I'd be happy to, but, you know, I'm hungry. I'd really like to go on my alms rounds, get my lunch, and then I'll be happy to teach you. Well, you need to know, at least if this is true, if you want something from the Buddha, if you're persistent and ask 3 times, he usually breaks down and says yes. So Bahiya said to the Buddha, said, how do you know that I'm not going to be dead this afternoon? And as the myth goes, the Buddha looked into his wisdom mind, saw that that might be true, so he decided he would give Bahiya's teaching, and it's one of the shortest teachings, if not the shortest teaching, in the 84,000 teachings that are attributed to the Buddha. He obviously wanted to get his lunch. But the good part about that is it means it really condenses down all that we really need to know. And so what the Buddha said to Bahiya is, he said, in the seeing, there is only that which is seen. In other words, there's no one who is seeing. In the hearing, there's only that which is heard. In the felt, there's only that which is felt. In the cognized, there's only that which is cognized. When for you, Bahiya, in the seen, there's only that which is seen. In the heard, there's only that which is heard. And in the cognized, there's only that which is cognized. You, as a person, will be neither here nor there, and then you will be free. And as the story goes, Bahiya was immediately open to that teaching, got it, okay, was enlightened. And as the story goes, that afternoon, he was gored by a water buffalo and died. But he at least died enlightened. So identifying with being the one who is hearing, thinking, seeing, feeling is not part of the experience. It's something extra that the mind adds. Because in truth, all that is happening is hearing, itching, thinking, emoting. In relating to our experience and what is arising in this way, we collapse the subject-object duality, the misperception that there is someone here having an experience, and that someone is separate from the experience. In reality, all there is the experience. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, a famous Tibetan teacher, said, "In fact, it is dubious one can even speak of experiencing reality, since that would imply a separation between the experiencer and the experience. That's breaking the subject-object duality." At the end of the Bahiya Sutra, it states, "You will be neither here nor there, then you will be free." So what does that mean for you? Take a few moments to reflect. What does it mean to be free? Free from physical pain? Free from emotional pain? I don't think so. This is not freedom from something. This is not freedom from the past or from the future or from our desires. It's freedom from living with self-constructed boundaries that limit our experience of joy, love, and peace. It's freedom from identifying with those aspects of life that we normally identify with as being who we are. Rather than identifying with what arises, there is the recognition you are the space as and through which life manifests. Very different perception. Now, this requires what's called a figure ground shift. To recognize that we are not objects in space, we are space in which objects arise. Now, for those of you who haven't taken a beginner psychology course, I'm curious how many people don't understand what I'm saying when I say, talk about a figure ground shift. Okay, I'm prepared. Okay, this is something called Rubin's vase. This is often how a figure ground shift is demonstrated. So if you focus on the black as the background, then what is in the foreground is the white vase. If you focus on the white as being the background, what you experience or see in the foreground is the two faces facing each other. That's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about a figure ground shift. The shift from seeing ourselves as an object in space to recognizing we are the space in which objects arise. And remember last night's pointing out instruction was a way to start to maybe see that in the context of your practice. Now, as I mentioned Monday, the mental construct of self is reinforced through the concept of time. It occurs because of memories which create the illusion of a self that has existed in the past, and the mind's ability to project and imagine future creates the illusion there's a self that will live at some point in the future. The idea of a thinker, an I distinct from the experience, comes from memory and the rapidity with which thought changes. If you imagine that memory is a direct knowledge of the past, rather than a present experience of thinking, you get the illusion of having a past and a present at the same time. The past is actually a present moment of thought. That's all it is. However, we reason, I know this present experience, and it's different from the past experience. If I compare the two and notice that they've changed, then I must be something apart from the two experiences. But memory is just really an experience in the present moment. When we clearly see that memory is a present moment experience, it becomes obvious that trying to separate ourselves from the experience is impossible. They're simply the experience. We need to be careful, however, not to fall into the trap to start to believe that there is no self. The teachings on no self or selflessness is merely pointing to wrong view rather than a negation of some entity called the self. Everything arises through causes and conditions. Craving and clinging is not done by the self, but the self concept arises when there's identification with craving and clinging. Freedom occurs when, in the addition to the absence of self-perceptions, there's also an absence of worry that there might be a self that I'm not merely seeing. There has to be an unshakable, absolutely clear awareness that nothing is a self and nothing belongs to a self. Even in letting go of the self, however, the self can arise. This is demonstrated in a story from the Jewish tradition. It's about a rabbi who was in the synagogue up praying in front of the altar, and he was just overcome, and he looked up and got down on his knees and said, "God, you are everything and I am nothing." Well, the cantor happened to be in the synagogue, heard what the rabbi was saying. He was inspired. He got down on his knees as well and he said, "God, you are everything and I am nothing." The janitor happened to be cleaning the synagogue. He heard what these two men said. He was inspired. So he got down on his knees. He said, "Oh God, you are everything. I am nothing." The rabbi turned to the cantor and said, "Look who thinks he's nothing." The self is hard to get rid of, even when we're trying to be selfless. Okay, that's the point. There is a term in the Zen tradition that's called shunyata. Shunyata means emptiness or devoid of essence. It applies to all phenomena, not just sentient beings. And it's another way to reflect on the concept of selflessness. In the Heart Sutra, it states, "The essence of all sentient beings is emptiness. There is nothing in them to be emptied out of them. They are already Buddhas. Their Buddha nature does not need to be established." That's very clear. Now, in that tradition, there are four characteristics of being void or empty of self. So the first is to feel that there is nothing which is me. So what does that mean, to feel that there is nothing that which is me? It means to recognize that I'm not the body, I'm not feelings, I'm not perceptions, I'm not mental formations, I'm not consciousness. I'm not the knower, I'm not the witness, I'm not the experiencer. I'm not the one who is stuck, I'm not the one who is clear, I'm not the one who is confused, I am not the one who is in pain, I'm not the one who is angry or sad or happy. So that's the first one, to feel that there is nothing which is me. The second one is to be without worry or doubt that anything might be me. So the first statement is a statement of the insight or the realization. The second characteristic is to check out within oneself, is this truly an insight or merely a cognition? So to be without worry that anything might be me means to be without worry about the body, to be without worry about the mind, to be without worry about moods, to be without worry about doubts, to be without worry about confusion. It's easy to say that I am clear that there is nothing that is me, but if we are worrying about the body, our state of mind, or whether or not we'll become clear, we haven't internalized this insight. It's just a cognition. The third characteristic is to feel that there is nothing which is mine. This can be very difficult. It means I don't have a partner, I don't have children, I don't have a job or a career, I don't have abilities, I don't have faults, this is not my life. It's easy to say that we're not those things, but how do we determine in reality if this is truly the case? Well, this relates to the fourth characteristic. To be without worry or doubt that anything might be mine. It means that I don't worry about my partner, my children, my work, my past, my future. It means because if I am worrying about any of these things, it's because I am believing that they are mine or belong to me. There is a danger in these kinds of conversation for many people, however, because it can feel quite cold and uncaring and very detached. You know, you might say, but I'm a parent. Aren't parents supposed to worry about their children? Isn't it normal if you're a parent to worry about your children? Well, it is if you believe you have children. But if you are living in the absolute reality, you see that everything is nothing but the magical display of the mind. When you see truly that there is no self, then you realize there can be no other than self. Everything takes place within consciousness. The whole world arises in your consciousness. There's nothing outside of it. It's all the play of consciousness. And in the Hindu tradition, they refer to this as Layla, the play of consciousness. It's all a play of consciousness. The problem is we get lost in the play. We get identified with our parts, forgetting it's just a play. You have nothing that isn't arising in your consciousness right now. And because consciousness can only have one object at a time, if you are seeing me, I am your entire world. There is nothing that exists outside of the senses that are arising for you right now. It all takes place within consciousness. This is your entire world. When you imagine that you have a family, a house, it doesn't mean that those things exist. It means that thoughts of those things are arising to consciousness right now. If that is understood, then there is the realization that there is no self. We realize that self is just a fabrication. It's a cluster of images that we keep. And so the self then becomes a thought. Whatever we identify with becomes the self. Therefore, when we realize that it is all empty, that nothing truly exists, it's only the play of consciousness unfolding from moment to moment, then the self disappears and other disappears. One way you can realize there's still delusion in the mind is if you worry about anything. If you worry about money, career, your family, health, spiritual development, if you worry, you are believing in either an I or a mind. One who has clarity has a complete absence of worry, a complete absence of doubt. That's the litmus test for us. In truth, there is one basic organic reality, and within that reality, there is only the arising of this magical display, the play of consciousness. When ego-grasping consciousness is gone, one does not look upon anything as having been ourself, as being ourself right now, or having the potential to be ourself in the future. There's no worry about the self in the past, the present, or the future. At the start of this talk, I mentioned that we need to see through the illusion of self to see what is true. And I'd like to finish this talk with a quote from a book titled A Practical Guide to Death and Dying. To lose an illusion means only to see more clearly. That is the challenge of human existence. To see, to know, to be as fully and truly as the God in hiding that we are. To drop the primal E and add the final D, to go from ego to God. That is what this book is ultimately about. Egoing, egoing, egon. And all that is left is all, with a capital A. What then is there to fear? So I'd like to offer you a practice now that actually comes from the Advaita tradition that many people, for including myself, have found profoundly helpful in shifting from identifying with this as being who I am. And the practice is called self-inquiry. Now, it means self-investigation, self-examination, self-reflection, or looking within, but self-inquiry seems to be the standard translation. But the term can be misleading. We're actually not looking or inquiring into the self. As I mentioned earlier, we're trying to penetrate the illusion that there is a self. Because what remains when the illusion disappears is space or emptiness. The basic reality is that the I is nothing more than a thought or idea, what we might call the I thought, which identifies itself with the body and mind. I am this body, I am this mind. A key understanding to do this practice is to recognize that the I thought only arises in terms of an action or ownership. For example, I meditate, I'm eating, I see, I think, I'm angry, this is my house, this is my car, this is my body, these are my thoughts. The I thought attaches itself to action or ideas of ownership, and it creates the illusion that there's an individual self that inhabits the body and controls all its thoughts and actions. Thus, the idea that one is an individual person is generated and sustained by the I thought and its habit of constantly attaching itself to actions, ideas of ownership, and also intentions as they arise to consciousness. So one can short-circuit this process by starving the I of its actions, ownerships, and intentions that it normally identifies with. So if we can break the connection between the I thought and the phenomena with which it identifies with, the I thought will just gradually fall away and disappear. Because when you starve something, it gradually just dies away. So this is done by asking the process who every time an experience arises to consciousness. So if there's thinking, you immediately look, who's thinking? If there's seeing, who's thinking? If there's feeling, who's feeling? Now, there has to be immediacy from having the experience arise to consciousness to the looking, to see if there is a who. This is not an intellectual inquiry. It does not look to come up with a cognitive answer. This is really important. It's looking to see truly if there is a self behind, as a part of, or in control of any of our experience. The result is, I will suggest, that no who will be found, but you need to realize this for yourself to have the insight. After every looking, you may discover a profound sense of peace, emptiness, spaciousness, and freedom, because there is no self to be found. But the looking needs to be immediate, as if your life depended upon it. You're going to prove that the Buddha is wrong, that there is a self, and I'm going to find it. That's really, because only through your direct experience, when you're convinced from looking to see, I can't find a self, will that insight be yours. Now, you might need to be on the lookout for very subtle of senses that of self that can arise when we do this. So we say, who's thinking? And of course, the mind will come back, well, it's I that's thinking. Or it's me that feels. Or how do I know there's no I just because I'm not seeing one right now? When those thoughts arise, we need to look again. Who's thinking? See, this requires a real sense of energy. It can be exhausting when you do this, but if you persist at it, really, freedom can happen. This is the practice that Nisargadatta Maharaj did. He was advised by his teacher to do this and basically was enlightened in 3 years, as the story goes. So this is a powerful practice. The word inquiry, however, leads many people to wrongly think that the technique is associated to do with more than asking questions rather than focusing our attention. And since the technique initially involves a question, that's kind of understandable. Eventually, if you persist at this practice of continuing looking, going who, it actually becomes your all-day practice. You're constantly looking to see the who. And at some point, the questioning falls away and there's just the looking, until it's clear to you there is no who to be found. So what is left without the illusion of a self? Unborn awareness, but you need to see this for yourself. So, we can do just for a brief time, but this is a practice, as I've just kind of alluded to, that's not just one you do on the cushion. You can do it all day long. So let's just do it for a few minutes, and then you can shift to Feldenkrais. So get in your sitting position. Center yourself with the breath. If a thought arises, immediately look, who's thinking? If an emotion like sadness arises, who's sad? If the mind comes back and says, well, it's me that's sad, look again, who's thinking that? Keep looking with immediacy after there's an expression of I to see the space, the emptiness from which the statement arose.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.